Right, can we start off just by establishing how you became involved with Greenham, how you became aware of the movement?
I was at university in Southampton between 1982 and 1985. So my first awareness of Greenham was getting in a bus with lots of other people from our university women's group and going up to Embrace the Base and joining in Greenham from there, and spent one summer living at the camp and also got involved in an organisation called Cruise Watch, which used to chase around the country, chasing after convoys of lorries carrying cruise missiles.
Right, right. So was that at the specific, you were actually put in a bus and went up for the specific Embrace the Base movement, that particular event?
Yes, so there's a whole group of us who hired a bus and went up. I think we got one of the university minibuses and drove up. And I remember being quite kind of apprehensive and not really knowing what it was going to be like, and because obviously there'd been various bits in the media and it sounded exciting, but also it was a bit trepidatious, and coming from a very middle class background and not having done anything like protesting or anything before. Yeah. But it was quite joyful when we got there and just saw all of these waves and waves of women arriving and just walking around the fence and the perimeter, and just seeing the fence festooned with ribbons, with teddy bears. People have put little messages on, little tiny baby clothes all attached. And then just talking to people as well and just coming across such a wide range of different people.
Don't worry, let me just grab the phone. That's all right, I'll just... Okay, so you mentioned that you spent a summer there. So what roles and activities were you part of? You've mentioned Embrace the Base. What else?
So I spent one summer there with some of my housemates and fellow university students.
Year was that?
I think it was 1984 or it might have been 1983. I just cannot remember which year it was. So there was a whole group of us there, and we had our own sort of camp within the camp, really. So we had lots of our own tents, and then we had one big tent, which was kind of like a food tent. And we all put in little bits of money and somebody would go off and do the supply run. And I think once every 2 weeks, someone would drive us into Newbury. We'd have a bath in somebody's house. But there were six of us and we all had to share one bath. So I'm not sure whether we actually got very clean. I remember getting into this bath, like the third person in, and like the whole surface of this bath was just floating with sort of debris. But, you know, at least you felt like you'd had a bath. And we did all sorts of activities there in terms of, you know, just sort of establishing a community and doing crafting activities and sort of cooking and sharing out those basic things. And then some of us broke into the base, so that again was quite exciting. So I remember this great big huge pair of bolt clippers, but nobody could actually but you had to hide the bolt clippers, because if anyone saw them, they'd take you off and arrest them. So my friend, who's called Helen Joyce, had this like huge pair of dungarees, and so she stabbed them down the front of her dungarees. And then so one night we clipped back the wire, and then we all just went under the fence. I think we kind of crawled under the fence and then just like ran out onto the runway, which pitch black. And then I remember being really, really scared, but also quite exhilarated as well. And then eventually the airmen came out and dragged us off. And of course you had to lie down and just go limp, and they just dragged you off. And then they just put you on a bus and threw you out the base. They just took us out, they didn't arrest us. So we did that a few times, that was quite fun.
So having obviously got outside the base, you say threw you out. Yeah. I mean, they just let you all out and you just walk back to wherever
exactly.
you started.
Yes.
Right.
And did it again. I mean, I think that was quite early days. Obviously, sort of later on, they got much more violent with people, and then they started arresting people. And so one of my housemates, a lady called Helen Joyce, she, I think by our second year at university, she was pretty much living there. At Greenham, and so she was being arrested all of the time, and she went to prison a few times. Sometimes people would pay the fine, even though you say you didn't want to, but yeah, she went to prison several times. And one time she was arrested and put on a like a big lorry, and then the police just literally threw her out the lorry as it was speeding along, and she came back, she was just covered in cuts and bruises.
Good heavens. There's obviously no repercussions for that. I mean,
no, that's just what they did.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you say so. Was that the our police or the military police?
I don't remember. There were military police on the base, plus right. there were civilian police as well. So like, every time you drove around the base, someone would follow you in your car. But sometimes it was military police, sometimes it was civilian police.
Right, right. You just said earlier that you sort of set up camp. Did you set it up at one of these gates,
Yes, I can't remember whether we were at Orange Gate or Blue Gate, and I think we used to go between the two different gates, actually.
Right.
But we had kind of like a little field that was just away from one of the gates, just sort of back towards the woods a little bit.
So did you sort of feel that you had integrated the gates? I think
just because we were, you know, like the Southampton women. So, you know, the Southampton women were there.
Right.
But that didn't mean that, you know, you were a complete, you know, isolated community.
Right.
So, you know, you would integrate with everybody else as well.
Okay. So what, I mean, was there any significance to orange or blue as far as you were aware?
There was a whole load of different communities who all lived at different gates, and there was one gate where there was just loads and loads of artists, and another gate where there were loads of musicians, and there was one gate that didn't talk to the other gate because somebody had done something and they all hated each other, and there was lots of factionalism. So, you know, and some people would live in one particular place and wouldn't go to another particular place. My memory has gone, and I just cannot remember enough about who lived at what gate.
It strikes me. You're remembering an awful lot, so don't worry at all. So yes, you said that you spent about 6 months, or just the summer,
That was just the summer break in between uni terms.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
Obviously, being the summer, it was very nice, and we had good weather, and we didn't have to cope with the mud and the wind and the rain, which everybody else had to cope with.
Absolutely. You mentioned the fact that on a number of occasions you broke in to the camp. Into the base. And any other activities? What other activities did you take part in?
I mean, I think the kind of the bigger memory for me was doing the cruise watch and chasing around the countryside.
Right, and so from your point of view, what was the setup there?
So basically, how it worked was this was pre-digital days, so we only had landline telephones, and being a poor student, I didn't even have a phone in my house. So there was a whole network, a telephone tree network. What would happen was, as soon as the cruise missiles left the base, somebody at one of the gates would get on the phone, mm-hmm. and then this whole like alert system would just cascade down, and that would go all over the neighbouring counties. So people from Oxford, you know, people from Reading, Southampton, and some people from London came as well. So there was a huge group of people. So personally, my friend would get the call, then she'd get on her bike, come and tap on my window. And I'd be like, oh no, the cruise missiles. So I get on my bike, and then we'd all cycle up to the uni, and somebody would come around with a bus, and we'd all pile into the bus.
Yeah.
So I remember one day being in this minibus, which was driven by a lady called Di MacDonald, who was one of the big people in Cruise Watch. Mm-hmm. I think there was about six of us in this minibus. Mm-hmm. We were just chasing after this lorry. I don't know what happened to everybody else, but we seemed to be on our own, and we just kept driving and driving. And
so
then,
was this one of these huge?
Yes, huge, big. They were huge, huge, enormous lorries. Mm-hmm. And this again was quite early days, and so we're in this little white minivan chasing after it, and everyone was like, where are we, where are we going? And we just said, well, just keep going. So we were driving all around the middle of Salisbury Plain, and by this stage we'd lost the cruise lorry, and we were going, well, it's over there in the woods or everything. Let's just go and have a look there to see. So just driving around completely lost as we play, and then all of a sudden, like, about five big huge army tanks came up and pulled in front of us and pulled to the side, and then a police car came up and made us all get out and carted us all off to Salisbury Police Station.
I was going to say, was that because you were up on the plane? Because that's
yes.
Military defence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we charged, and they charged us as a trespass, but they never prosecuted us, so they let us go. Yeah. So that, again, was quite an experience. So, I mean, mean, but other times, you know, you would just literally be there just chasing after them all over the country. Yeah. And you used to meet all sorts of very different people and just hear some amazing stories. So, I mean, I think, you know, in a pre-digital age as a resistance network, it was pretty well organised.
Absolutely. I mean, just going back on something that I just can't quite get the logistics of. So the phone call used to go out from one of the gates. Had they actually got a landline?
They used to get to a phone box.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and sometimes the phone boxes weren't working, but... or other people would drive to a nearest phone box and start off the telephone tree.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think we used to have code words. For some reason, I remember somebody going, "The penguins are flying tonight," but I don't know whether that's a false memory or not. But there were all sorts of code words that you used to have as well.
Fascinating.
But and when they set off, you had no idea where they were going to go to. Sometimes they would go to Salisbury Plain, sometimes that, you know, they would go out to other places, sometimes they would just drive around the roads.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I mean, you know, just the idea was just to be disruptive, really, just to say, we know that you're here, we know what you're doing, and, you know, we're not letting you get away with it.
Mm-hmm. So, as far as the time you spent in the camp, what was the setup sort of day to day? I mean, what was the routine?
I don't think there was really any routine. I think you just made your own routine, really. People would do... I guess you describe them as workshops, really. Lots of people doing craft things, so spinning massive big webs. There was lots of singing went on.
You mentioned actually.
I can't remember the song. Because I remember going home to my parents' home and singing this song. My brother actually tried to kill me if I sang the song. Yo, kill the spirit. You can't kill the spirit. Yeah. And I would just like sing that on repeat. So we did lots and lots of singing. But I think it was just talking, really. Just talking with lots of other women and hearing people's different stories. And, you know, where people had come from. And, you know, there was all sorts of women there, you know, from all sorts of backgrounds.
Yeah.
And, it's, you know, just... You know, especially just being a very young woman, and just fascinating to hear all of the different experiences of people. And then there are all sorts of factions. So, you know, there was like... God, I can't remember all the factions. I just remember now that there were lots and lots of factions. And so, yeah, different people didn't talk to each other.
I was going
to
say, was that because of different views about what
was
going on?
Yeah, it was different. It was different political. Some of it was personal, but a lot of it was political as well. Mm. But also, especially in the summer, lots of people there with their kids as well, which is great. And there were sort of creches set up, and people look after the kids and take it in turns to look after kids, which, you know, it was just like a fantastic community, really. You know, and like with all communities, people come together and people fall out and disagree.
Yeah, I've got no idea of numbers. So, for instance,
in our little camp, there was probably about 100 people or so living in our little bit. But you know, that was just people, you know, that I knew who were there.
So that was
but,
just a small
yeah,
part of
that was
it
just
at
a small
time.
Part of it at that time.
Interesting. What, I mean, in terms of catering, did you all cook together or did you all just take responsibility?
Yeah, so we had like, it was a bit like Girl Guides, really. We had this like massive big food tent and so people donate food. So if food got dropped off at the main gate, that would get shared out.
Yeah.
And then we'd all sort of club together, people who could afford it, and we'd go and buy stuff in town.
Yeah.
Then someone would make a big vat of porridge in the mornings. That was really disgusting.
Making it or eating it.
Yeah, and then we could sort of had a rota and people take turns to make food in the evenings. Mm. And, you know, you could have some if you wanted to or if you didn't. Mm. Yeah, I mean, quite often you used to go around and chat with people at other gates, and if they were cooking, you know, you'd sit and eat with them. It was all very communal.
Mm. What was the sanitation?
See, I've been trying to remember this and I cannot remember.
What
I mean,
we must have
just gone behind a tree somewhere. Okay.
Really?
Yeah, but so, I just cannot remember.
No pits dug.
I mean, there must have been, but it's really weird. I don't. My brain has just remembered.
You're the first person I've thought to ask.
my brain has only remembered the really exciting bits, and it's forgotten all of the bits, like, you know, where did you go to the loo?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember taking a wash because it was just bizarre. Because I don't even remember where we got the water from. Mm. You know, and there were no standpipes, so we must have got water from somewhere. And again, I just don't remember that. But we must have just gone behind a tree.
Yeah. And what about the education of the children that were there, or the age? Well, first of all, the age of the children.
So it was mostly just young children, because I think that I can't remember what the rule was for boys. So there were some young boys there, but I can't remember whether it was 10 that they didn't want any boys there from. I think they did some sort of makeshift schools and things, but again, I just don't remember that.
No.
Yeah, no. I wasn't really part of it, so I don't remember it.
Was there a particular gate that you're aware of that families congregated at?
Yeah, or? Again, there was, but I just, again, it's something I don't remember,
Doesn't
sorry.
Matter. There's no point in making it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about sort of relationship and influence from other women?
In terms of leadership, do you mean?
Well, yes, or I was thinking, particularly yourself, in terms of, did you feel, I mean, you're obviously a student, and you've mentioned Helen Joyce, a couple of other people. I mean, did they have an influence on you? So did you have a relationship?
I think there was kind of an awe of the women who'd sort of set it up originally, and the people who had become sort of spokeswomen for the camp, I guess. Mm. And there was that kind of awe of, you know, the legacy of those people. But equally, it was also a space for anybody. Mm. So there wasn't really any sort of hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of up to you to do what you wanted to do and to join in whatever you wanted to join in. I didn't ever feel any pressure to do anything. Or I think, you know, it was just a kind of that sort of collective space, really.
Right. Did you see how decision-making operated?
Again, it was very collective. So, you know, people would sit and talk about things and argue and discuss and come to a consensus, mostly. Right. I think that, you know, there were one or two people who tried to be quite bossy. But, you know, if you're in a collective space, it doesn't really work. You have to sit and listen. And I think that it's probably quite frustrating for people at times if you're used to very traditional models of leadership where you're told what to do and you follow them. But again, it's, you know, if you're doing something and you're doing something on a voluntary basis and you're giving up your time and you're not being paid for it, then, you know, you're all equal. You're all equal stakeholders. You're all equal parts of the collective.
Yes. I mean, did you encounter conflict at any point within those discussions, and was there a way in which it was managed?
I mean, there was a lot of political decisions. So a lot of my friends became involved in the Wages for Housework campaign. And I think so a lot of the Greenham people joined that.
Was that at that time?
So yes, that was at that time. And so I think, you know, and again, it was just because you were in a space where you were sort of being made aware of lots and lots of different political views and all the different campaigns that were going on. I think possibly some people had more influence than others. But again, it was really up to you. You know, it was up to you to decide what you wanted to do. No one would force you to break into the base if you didn't want to. Mm. No one would force you just to lie on the road and, you know, if you didn't want to. And so everybody kind of did what they wanted to do or what they were able to. I mean, some people weren't able to do those sort of things.
Did you feel that your whole approach to conflict, resolving disputes, changed at all as a result? And did you learn something from that approach?
I mean, it was quite interesting because I was a politics student at the time, and one of the trips that we did was a trip to NATO. And we sat in a room with all of these generals. You know, again, this was in the mid-1980s when America believed that you could have contained war in Europe within a European theatre. And it was very interesting just like talking to these people and saying, do you not have any, you know, moral responsibility? And just this kind of the very cold and very analytical responses that they gave, where, you know, they would talk about, you know, being able to manage this amount of loss of lives and everything. And then contrasting that with, you know, an experience like Greenham where you had, you know, possibly a much more, to the military mind, a very chaotic and not organised, no discernible leadership, no discernible structures. But out of that, just this, you know, sort of tremendous will and this feeling of being part of very, you know, of a collective and being part of a very powerful movement, you know, just founded on, you know, morality and belief and passion. Mm. And I think, you know, that was sort of one of the things I've always taken away from Greenham, just that feeling of strength and strength of being with people who think like you and are prepared to act.
And how did that, how do you feel that strength came about? By sheer numbers or from belief?
I think probably both. So, again, you know, sort of in the early 80s, just this terrible fear. I kind of look, contrast it now with the young people who are doing climate change protests, you know, and this feeling that, you know, they've only got 12 years left to save the earth. And it was that same kind of feeling, you know, this feeling that these men in charge are going to destroy the world, and what can you do about it? And so, you know, just being able to join Greenham, and also because it was, you know, women-only protest, and just women being powerful and acting together, again, was so powerful. And so that just again reinforced probably my beliefs, but also made me feel that I wasn't powerless, because there is strength, as you say, in numbers, and there is strength in continuing to act. And even if, you know, you're not getting your message across in the mainstream media, you're getting your message across by talking to people, by acting. I mean, these again were in the days before social media. It would have been a lot easier with social media now. But, you know, so people would come a visit and you would talk to them and have discussions with people. And even when you went away, you still took that message. So, and then people would, you know, write their own stuff or perform stuff or do singing or whatever. And so, again, that was another way of just sort of spreading the message.
When they were writing, performing, do you feel that they were taking that out to a wider audience?
So, yes, exactly. So, I mean, you know, one of the themes of Greenham was always about web and reweaving the web and taking this non-violence and weaving a web of connections. And I think that that's what it did. You know, if that was the centre of the web, but all of these threads went out, you know, all over the UK and all over the world. And I think it was quite powerful as well, sort of seeing the peace movement happening in Germany, especially in Eastern Germany as well, and sort of making those connections with different European capitals who were all protesting. And again, you know, they say that Greenham didn't achieve anything, but then you look at, you know, Gorbachev, who specifically said that the peace movement was one of the reasons why he started talking to the West.
So I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Sorry, no, only because it's help if I could spell Gorbachev. Anyway, never mind. I know what it is.
You call him Gorby.
Gorby, absolutely. Just, you've alluded to it, the lack of presence at the camp. Do you feel that men could have been there, or did men have a role at all within Greenham?
So I think what was really exciting was that the men were doing the support. So the men were doing the looking after the kids. The men were bringing, you know, the food, they were donating, and you know, they were helping in other ways as well. So again, especially in Crew's Watch, a lot of men were part of that because they felt that that was something they could do. Although a lot of them did get quite into sort of driving around and showing off and being lots of the kind of boys in cars and things, because they kind of said, oh, this, you know, the women are at the camp, this is our bit, this is what we can do. And we're like, no, 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 you still have to do it, you know, non-violently. And so I think, again, that was quite powerful. I mean, a lot of men didn't get it. They just didn't understand why it was women only.
Right. And did they resist that, or did they try and overcome
it? It's just, I think it's just, especially with the left, and it was true then, it's true now. I think the men in the left feel that they need to own everything. And so especially with the far left, they can't understand that it's not about them. And I think that was quite difficult. But I think it's about seeing something that's successful and it's happening without them. And so actually, you know, this isn't about you. Your role is to stand back and to support. And, you know, I mean, the feeling was, you know, the men, the patriarchy have made this mess. You know, it's up to the women now to take action. All of the kind of, oh, yeah, but I'm not like that. Well, that's fine, but, you know, do this and support. And there was, you know, they would people who would just come and, you know, throw things and throw packages of excrement and spit at you. And
did that tend to be male?
So they would come up to the camp, and then they would, you know, there would just be like a posse of women who would just eventually scare them off. But, you know, everyone was always happy to have debate and to discuss, and, you know, there was never any violence. Mm. I mean, and eventually they would go. But, you know, and people come visit, especially people who have kids as well. So guys would come up and visit, but they wouldn't stay.
Yeah. Well, people coming to visit, did you get media coming to visit? Or?
Yeah, so you would, on the days of the big actions, of course, yes. Right. You would get lots and lots of media attention. But day to day,
that was just on a daily basis rather than coming to understand and to be able to take a story away.
Again, depending on which media it was, really. Mm. So, you know, if it's mainstream news media, it would just be about the event. Mm. People like Spare Rib, Peace News, Guardian would spend time there and, you know, sort of discuss. Mm. But yeah, mostly mainstream media wasn't really. I think there were a few people, but again, I don't really think I was long enough there really to have any of those kind of relationships with journalists.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were part of or joined in the Embrace the Base. You from time to time went onto the base. Are there any other events or sort of means of protest that you were a part of that you can call?
I remember going to a massive big demonstration, but this was in London outside Grosvenor Square. But I cannot remember what it was for, but I remember us all lying in the road. And again, getting dragged off by the police.
And that was the time of Greenham?
Yes, but it must have been around that time. I think it must have been a massive big CND demonstration. Yes, yeah. Yeah, and that was in London. Yeah, we were all blockading the road. And yes, and I remember getting dragged off by the police. And the police officer said, right, you're arrested. And then you stay there. And she wandered off. So I went, right, well, I'm not staying here to be arrested, and wandered off myself. Well, lots of other people were getting put in the van. So that, again, was just quite a bizarre experience. But, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you got used to just sort of lying in the road and going limp and being dragged off.
Yeah, yeah. So this business of going limp, was that something that was part of the tools that you
we did some like mini training, so people would tell, you know, say, right, okay, well, this is what we do, and I think I'm sure we did some practicing, just sort of lying down on the ground and being dragged off by people, and people who'd done it before would come and tell you how to do it. Mm. That's about the extent of the training that I remember that we had. It wasn't really training, it was just sort of sharing knowledge.
Did you have any, obviously, being arrested and being freed or whatever with the police, but did you have any other interaction with police?
Only when we used to drive up to Greenham and they used to come and drive past you, and they would always just stop you and take all your details, your car and things. And the house I lived in, they used to come sit outside with their police car. I'm not quite sure what they were trying to do apart from intimidate us, but that pretty much was it, really. Mm. Again, you know, we weren't core people, we were just
peripheral. Did you have any interaction with bailiffs, anything like that?
No.
What about local residents? You mentioned that you went down and had a bath in Newbury. Was that somebody you supported?
So that was a supportive person, yeah. And again, I wasn't sort of part of any of that discussions with local residents.
Did you go
down
shopping in
Newbury? I didn't, no.
Were you aware of any political infiltration or sabotage going on at all?
I know in hindsight that there was, and I'm sure there was. I don't think I met anybody that I would recollect.
No, and so even with the benefit of hindsight, you can't, hand on heart, say that you...
No.
Yeah, no.
I mean, and you met so many different people there.
Yeah. What about... how would you represent Greenham artistically?
Possibly as a patchwork quilt, and just a joining together of lots of different, very diverse experiences, women from all over the UK, all over the world, different races, different classes, different sexualities, but just this kind of idea of everyone being part of this greater whole. So pictorially, yes, I guess a quilt, and then possibly a web as well, just of interconnecting threads and you know, just and very vibrant, very sort of all different colours and all the different colours of the spectrum. Just and that pictorially, I think, would sort of represent everyone's sort of different opinions as well.
Yes, very graphic. During this period, how did you, when you were a student, how did you interact with your family?
So my family were like, you know, nice middle class man. Well, I mean, my parents were both came from very, very poor working class backgrounds, right. And, you know, were probably quite very traditional. And then sort of, you know, having had this experience and then going back and talking to my parents, and they're like, oh yeah, okay, fine, you're just doing the rebelling phase or whatever. But talking with my mother, I think that was really exciting because she finally managed to get it. So the second big demonstration we had, she got all of her friends to come on a bus and join in as well, which was just amazing because she'd like never ever done anything like that before. So that was really exciting. And yeah, and I managed to meet her, and I don't know how we managed to do it without mobile phones, but yeah, and all of her friends. So yeah, that was great.
She had done it off her own bat.
Yeah, so
you were helping her at home, sort of.
So I said, well, I said that, you know, the next one is here. Why didn't you come? And she'd organised all her friends to get in a little minibus and come up. So yeah, all of her neighbours.
Wonderful. For it. How fabulous. Yeah. Did she continue the
support? No. She worked. I mean, she you know, she would support me, and I think we managed to get her on one demonstration in London. Yeah, I think that was about it. but you know, that in itself was like a small victory, really, just to get her to do that. So that was quite nice. Yeah,
it was wonderful.
Yeah, my brother just hated me singing the song, so I just kept singing it more and more and more.
What was his attitude towards the whole Green protest?
No, I did. I don't know. It wasn't that he disagreed.
No, just no, no. Hated, I wasn't he suggesting.
Just, he just hated
it was
me.
Your singing,
he
realised.
Hated my singing. Yes.
Right.
So you know, I mean, like, you know, I think they just thought, oh yeah, he's just going through that kind of rebel phase. Really, my family. You know, I mean, they didn't try to stop me.
No. So did the male members of your family, so your father and your brother, did they have sympathy towards the Greener movement?
No, not my father, but my two brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you have friends who were opposed to what you were doing?
No, because they wouldn't have been my friends. I mean, I had, you know, again, being a politics student, so you would sit and discuss in seminars, and of course, yeah, there were people there who were opposed. And you would try and debate, it was very interesting. And I don't think it's something that you have now because society has changed so much. But I think when you were trying to make an emotional argument, especially in academia, it was really dismissed. People wouldn't accept that as a valid argument
because of the emotion.
Yeah, because women and it was really interesting because women were seen as being emotional, and I remember this was the 1980s. So yeah, women were seen as being, you know, too emotional, whereas, you know, the men were the strategic and the analytical people, and they should take the decisions, and you should never take a decision based on emotions. It was really interesting, and because, you know, you're inspired to act because you feel a connection, and, you know, it is your feeling, it is your emotions that inspires you to act and get involved in things. Mm. I mean, you can do it on a rational and, you know, you can analyse the data as well. But anybody who I talked to was involved because they felt so strongly, you know, that this was a cause that they needed to join.
Do you think that emotion has be more acceptable in terms of decision making or politics?
I think now,
that
has changed an awful lot.
Can you give an example of that? I'm just trying to think. Well, it has improved the emotional aspect.
Well, I don't know if it's actually improved, but I mean, you can look at, for example, Brexit, which has been an entire, mostly an emotional campaign about, you know, how people feel. Which, you know, you can say it's backed up by data, but, you know, most, yeah, exactly, arguably, but, you know, but it's mostly been around feeling.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the thing that I would guess possibly is, you know, sort of after the Trump election 2017, when I got involved with Women's March, and again, that to me was like the first time since Greenham I'd seen that massive emotional outpouring of people, that people just felt so angry that they had to step up and do something. I mean, it was there with the Occupy movement as well, but I think, yeah, 2017 again is probably the closest I've seen.
Since that time, what course has your life taken?
So after I left uni, I got involved in the world of work, really. And then in the 90s, we were all lads and ladettes, weren't we? So we weren't feminists anymore. And then raising children. And interesting, really, because I have a son. And how do you raise a son?
What age is he now?
He's 21 now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in last year at university. Yes, and how do you, you know, raise a son and not give them tanks and not give them guns to play with? And raise them as a non-violent person, which I hope I've done a good job. I don't know. And then, yeah, so since he went to uni, I had a bit more time, so then started becoming politically active again at a great old age of in my 50s.
What do you think of the age? A lot of them were at Greenham age has got no barriers. Actually, just going back to your son... What is his, well, first of all, how aware of Greenham is he, or was he? And what is his feeling about his mother having been a part of Greenham?
I think he's proud. Well, he tells me he's proud. I think that's, I mean, he's quite politically active now, but he's involved in the climate change movement, and he is studying international development. So he's sort of, also involved in kind of, you know, limits to growth and global justice and things like that. So I don't think that's because of me. I think that's probably in spite of me.
But yeah. Well, it was your background as well.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, so I think he's proud of his mum.
Yeah.
Somebody, he did text me once going, "You are a really cool mum," and that's nice.
How wonderful. Well, yes, so to what extent do you feel that your experience at Greenham influenced your path?
In my life, I think I've just always been disruptive post-Greenham. I've always been an uppity woman. I've always been someone who won't settle for injustice. I've always been someone who speaks out. Far too aggressive, my mother said. You never find a man, you're far too aggressive. Again, you wouldn't do that now, you know, that was the 1980s. You know, I think I've always lived life on my own terms. I haven't really settled for things except for when I've had to. You know, and I've probably had a very comfortable life, really, you know.
Interesting, yeah. Obviously, you're talking about the fact that earlier about sort of non-violent action. Have you sort of used that aspect since in your tactics with people? Just interesting.
Yes, in terms of conflict resolution, but again, that's more just between people at work and just trying to diffuse situations and again, just getting people around and... talking, they call it active listening these days, but it's the same principle really, which is, you know, just sitting around and letting people be heard and by discussion and by debate coming to a resolution rather than some kind of hierarchical or obeying orders.
Right, and did you see any other areas in which non-violent action tactics have been used?
I think, I mean, when I was younger, as a reporter and was covering the poll tax riots, and again, that was, you know, a very kind of scary situation, just sort of being in those crowds of people. And I remember just like being this like really big mob of people and just trying to get everybody to calm down. I can't remember what happened. So that's probably not a great example for you.
No, it is. So, for instance, the poll tax riots, and I know, there was definitely pretty violent at times, but do you feel that there was an element of influence from Greenham's
No, I don't think that's a good example. Sorry. No. I've gone... is there anything... No, I can only think of it really in the workplace or in personal circumstances, but nothing kind of in a broader sense.
Oh, for instance, the Women's March. Do you feel that that?
Oh, okay. So yes. So basically, so we kind of organised 2017 Women's March on kind of Greenham principles, which is, you know, sort of collectively and collective decision making and a small group of people. I mean, that was really hard because it was a very short amount of time. There was an awful lot of work to do and no one had any experience at all in doing any of the jobs that had to be done. Mm. But that was all done collectively. Mm. Yeah, there was no leadership at all in that.
And it was deliberately non-violent.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone would even have, you know, sort of contemplated other than organising on sort of, you know, Martin Luther King, Gandhian non-violent principles.
Right. And so it didn't even have to be said.
No. Didn't even have to be said. But again, I think that was because, you know, women were organising it.
Very interesting, yes.
And you know, just, and also the lead from the US was, you know, with the MLK principles of nonviolence as well, which kind of, you know, disseminated around the world, really.
What do you feel is the legacy of Greenham for future generations?
I think the legacy of Greenham is that if you believe in something, stand up and do it, and you can change the world. Because everybody has power, and everybody has power within themselves to make change, to make a difference. And it doesn't matter what you do, however big or however small, everybody can do something. And if you feel powerless, remember that there is power in people coming together, whether it's two people, whether it's 200 people, 2,000 or 2 million people. Mm. And so therefore you're not alone. That's what I think is the legacy. Mm. Those are kind of big grand statements. I mean, I think...
Yeah.
I think, you know, just on a personal level, it's taught me how to be possibly in, you know, very difficult situations and deal with them. It's taught me not to have any fear. Mm. It's taught me just to believe in something and go with it, even if people are telling you not to. Mm. And it's taught me the power of working together, however difficult that is, that you can achieve things and you can make things happen, you know, and, you know, you can make the impossible happen.
Mm. What about feminism? Do you feel that it was a landmark as far as feminism was concerned? Or, I mean, obviously it was there before, but do you feel that...
Yes, and I think it was, and, you know, there is the kind of political legacy of women coming together and organising, you know, so... That whole legacy again of, you know, the kind of the suffragettes, you know, the Grunswick people, you know, the Bread and Roses protest, so many different organisations of women coming together and making change happen. Mm. I mean, you know, and for a lot of them with personal sacrifice. And so I would see Greenham very much in that kind of legacy of women coming together and making change happen.
Mm. Well, do you think it was a landmark in terms of, for instance, lesbianism?
Gosh, possibly. I mean, again, it wasn't, I wasn't really aware of that, so.
Yeah, even with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, yes, possibly, yes, because again, it was a safe space, and it was a safe space for women to be together.
Yes, I was sort of thinking in terms, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, absolutely. How well do you feel that what you did at Greenham has been relayed down through the generations?
I think, I mean, the problem is that if you look at the mainstream media, especially because of the kind of way things were structured in the 1980s, and, you know, the voices that were heard and the voices that were listened to, Greenham is seen as, you know, a lot of mad women who got together and lived in a wood with unkempt hair and were all a bit loony, and they're all lesbians and they hated men. And, you know, that is probably a narrative that, still exists. But, you know, and then there's another narrative, you know, where, you know, these women came together at an enormous personal cost and, you know, lived day to day right up against the site where cruise missiles were situated, and they disrupted the military, they disrupted the American government, and in the end they forced the Americans to get rid of the nuclear missiles, and they forced the West and Russia to start talking to each other. So, you know, that's on a big picture level. And I think people tell their own narratives and people tell their own stories. Mm. And so you have lots of people, you know, who've written since about Greenham, and people who've, you know, written plays, and you have artwork. And so there are lots of different ways of spreading stories and remembering history.
Yeah. You said earlier about Gorbachev saying that it was probably a factor in him talking to the US. Can you just elaborate on that?
So I think it was just, you know, in the darkest of times, there were people organising all over the West. Mm. And then I think, you know, brave people in Eastern Germany joining up as well with people in Western Germany, and you know, and then this massive peace movement that spread across Eastern Europe, and it was, you know, all underground, and people, you know, organised at great risk to themselves, but, you know, they kept organising and people kept coming and they didn't give up. Yeah. And, you know, and if you see that amount of dissent and, you know, that anger from the people, public protest in the end makes governments change. Because the more people who come and the more people don't go away, at some stage there's a tipping point and governments have to act. Mm. And I think that's what happened.
Gorbachev, for instance, is a very different personality to Putin, for instance.
Of course, yeah.
Supposing Putin had been there at the time, do you think that kind of movement would have had any impact on somebody of that personality?
See, but Putin, but it's different, isn't it? Because Putin is about disinformation and he's about disrupting, but he's about disrupting to his own agenda. So Putin possibly would have welcomed, you know, the peace movement in the West, because he would might have seen it as destabilizing Western governments. So I think we live in different times, don't we?
Yeah.
I think if you had that kind of similar thing now, social media would have made everything so different. I mean, because now people can organize that quickly, you know, it's a tweet, it's a Facebook event, it's, you know, it's a WhatsApp group, and, you know, and you get people out on the streets very quickly.
Do you think, how different do you think it would have been, in what ways do you think it might have been different with social media? Would it have been better, quotes, but I mean, it would have brought a different dynamic to it.
I think if you'd had social media, if you had the same thing happening with social media, I do not think that the government would have been able to guarantee to the US the safety of having cruise missiles on a base, because the ability of social media to mobilise so many people, you wouldn't have been able to get cruise missiles out on the road, because you could have had cars at every exit blocking them. And if you have that scale of mass civil disobedience, it's not manageable. So I don't know. I mean, who knows?
I think
you know, it would not be possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, we've just seen, you know, in the last 2 years how easy it is to mobilise people, to get people out on the streets, you know, to disrupt, to block traffic, and it doesn't take a lot of people.
No, that's interesting. What is there a sort of moment, emotional picture that for you actually sums up Greenham? I know you mentioned, I asked you artistically, but is there a moment or emotion?
I think the famous picture of the women dancing on top of the silos, because that is just amazing. I think for me, just being part of that huge, huge, huge wall of women holding hands around the base, and just the power of that is amazing. I don't know if you saw the pictures recently of the women's wall in India and Kerala.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, it's just that feeling, just all of these women standing together, and that's really powerful.
That image of surround the base, embrace the base, sorry. The power of that, could you feel it at the time, or is that something that you now realise was so powerful?
No, I think we knew at that time it was something extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that hadn't happened before.
Yeah.
And just this idea of just occupying this space and just being part of this massive chain of people was really exciting, very empowering.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, I think that for me is probably one of the memories. And I think the other memory is, you know, sort of clipping the wire and just rolling it back and sneaking under and sort of dancing on the runway is a personal memory.
Yeah.
Just again, because, you know, it was disrupting the establishment.
Mm. Yes, yeah. Finally, can I just ask you, can you explain why you think it's important that Greenham is remembered by subsequent generations?
Because we have to stop reinventing causes and issues every time. We have to learn from each other's experiences, and we have to say to each other, you're not the first people to do this, you are part of a huge chain of experiences and things that happen. And I think what happens is that, you know, people get involved in something and then it all just goes quiet, and then something else happens, and then people feel that they're doing it for the first time. And so there's so much, you know, that people can learn from each other and from each other's experiences. And also, you know, if it's like this, you know, this idea of this wave, and if this wave just keeps on going and going and grows and grows and grows and grows, eventually change will happen because it becomes unstoppable. And if you, but if you take part in something and you don't keep going, then you have to keep, you know, restarting it and rekindling it each time, and then it dies. So, you know, it's just really important. I mean, not just through media, through, you know, kind of press articles, but just through art, through, you know, performance, just to keep that legacy alive. And first-hand accounts from people who were there are so important. And, you know, just think what happened and how did they achieve that, and just, you know, learning those lessons and you know, moving it on. Because where we are now is because of, you know, so where we were in the 1980s were because of all the struggles that came before, and where young women are now is because of all the struggles, you know, that they've benefited from. I feel so inspired by Generation Z. I think the young women of Generation Z are amazing. And all the ones I've met are just, they're just so powerful. And, you know, they're just not taking any crap anymore. It's really exciting.
Do you think they're individually powerful, or is that a result of being in a collective?
I think just because they have the freedom to express their opinions, and they don't keep quiet, they don't feel they should, and, you know, they don't put up with crap, really. You know, if they're in abusive relationships, they call them out, and they support each other as well, which is good. And the whole body positive movement, I think, is amazing as well. So, you know, you do see all of those signs of change happening. And, of course, we've had Me Too and Time's Up as well, which is just keeps on empowering people. And you have really positive role models now. People just, Emma Watson's and, oh, my God, I've forgotten her name, the woman from The Good Place. Brain, it's gone. But you have so many amazing positive role models as well. And I think, you know, the good thing now is that I think Greenham felt like it was quite a white movement, and it was possibly quite middle class. And I think what's happened now in the women's movement is, you know, because intersectionality is just so important, and just seeing lots of new voices coming through as well is really exciting. So, you know, and that is so important as well.